Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, Vi Lyles returns from an extended summer vacation, and on the heels of her election to a fourth term as Charlotte's mayor, a lot has happened since our last visit in May, some just days or weeks ago, more like months ago. So let's get to it. Good morning. Welcome back to the program, Mayor.
Thank you, Mike, for giving me that opportunity to have a focus on both my family and my campaign. I'm really glad to say to all of your listeners, I hope you enjoyed the other mayors that you've heard Mike interview. It shows how much our region is growing and what we're doing. And so as we get into the holiday season, I just wish everyone the very best for their home and their family.
So you are back in office for your fourth term. Do you see this as an opportunity to push the envelope toward new endeavors or initiatives that you have put on the back burner for a while? Or do you see it mostly as a continuation of what you've already been doing?
You know, what's really interesting to me is that there's never a back burner idea or effort in this community anymore. We're still one of the fastest growing cities in the country. We're still trying to make sure that people have the quality of life that's necessary. And there are surprises that come every day in how do we do that? Sometimes it's challenges and sometimes it's really accolades. So this Monday night, we actually got a national award from the American Planning Association for the UDO that we adopted. It was one of four in the country. So that's the kind of thing that we love to always be able to talk about. But I also know that we have challenges to do those things and to take those initiatives.
Well, let's talk about that. I was going to put that toward the very end of the program, this award that the city received on the much-debated, now settled, though still unsettling, Charlotte UDO and the future 2040 comprehensive plan that frames it. This was an award from the American Planning Association, a national award. What is it given for? What is their criteria? And why were we among the four cities that got it?
Well, I think that the reason that we got it is the number of efforts that we put out to adopt the UDO. And by no means was this a unanimous opinion about our vote on our UDO, but the idea that we included the community, that we went out into the neighborhoods, the techniques that we did to get people to comment on what we were doing were really significantly different than the past of like, come down to the council and tell us what you think. What we did was we went out to every neighborhood and talked about how to play a game on this to get to a process. We engaged so many, hundreds of people in this effort. So part of this award was because of community engagement, and we continue to focus on that effort as we go about implementation of it. But so I think we also know that this was a long-term, it was over 3 years of work by our planning staff and keeping our current planner, Allison, as well as Taiwo, who helped introduce this to us. It was really an important part of what we needed to do. You know, when I came to Charlotte, I lived in Elizabeth in a place that was redlined, and my deed on my house said, no Negroes allowed, no colored people allowed. This UDO really takes a steady look at our history and tries to make us work towards more housing without restrictions that were in place many, many years. Even like in 1945, that was the last time we did something to change our zoning. And we have to begin to think about it differently. And the UDO is our shining star for that.
So let's back up a second for people who may not be aware of anything we're talking about, because there's so many people coming here all the time that we're not here for those discussions. Taiwo, right. the Taiwo that you referred to a moment ago is the former city planner, Taiwo Jioba, who took the job and began to embark on this plan and realized that to have a plan, a comprehensive plan, I think this is the order of events, you had to rethink the whole zoning process, hence the development of this unified development ordinance. And then the ratification, I think the ratification of, which came first, ratification of the UDO or the ratification of the plan?
Well, right now we are at the UDO ratification because that's what our zoning requirements are. But it's also the comprehensive plan because we have a playbook that says this is the kind of community that we want. So, for example, we want a community that has open space, sustainability, 10-minute neighborhoods. We want a plan that serves every resident of our city, not just some.
So the plan lays out what we'd like to be, and the Unified Development Ordinances are the playbook for how to get there, essentially,
yes,
and the rules that are in place to help mm-hmm. us get there. Both of them were hotly debated on City Council. I think both of them squeaked past on a yes vote. And evidently, Taiwo Jioba, who was the brainchild, this was his brainchild, has gone on to become the city manager in Greensboro, and he still evidently watches our city council meetings from afar. And he was interviewed by a publication called The Assembly. And he says, as he watches some of these debates, he gets a little concerned because he says it's a signal that the city's progressive new order may be a fragile one if it ever existed at all, because we are still debating some of the things in that Unified Development Ordinance, and City Council has ignored some of them already within a year of its passage. So is he right to worry?
I think it was a statement that he made because he has such a commitment to this effort and this plan. But I would have to say that what we're trying to do right now is to actually make it real on the ground. And whenever you have a massive plan like we have for UDO, we're going to have some debates and we're going to have some changes that we might have to make. But I think overall, if you look at what the intent and purpose is, the UDO is in good shape. We do have some things that we have to talk about, but I think now we've settled some of the major things. We know what our neighborhoods need to be like. Some of the things that we're talking about are probably more like, how do we get parking? How do we make sure that everyone has an opportunity to have a home to live in? So there are things that we have to do that fit right within our existing priorities. The UDO is where we are. You know, government has regulatory kinds of things that we have to do. And some of those regulations are now in place and they're not being changed. They're just, you know, how do we make sure that we can communicate what we're trying to accomplish?
Okay, so in the comments that you made leading up to this offshoot of talking about the UDO and the planning, the 2040 plan, you mentioned the words quality of life, because following your win in the primary, you said that quality of life issues, jobs, affordable housing, and safety were the most pressing issues facing the city of Charlotte. Explain quality of life. What do you mean by that?
You know, for me, I always think about quality of life is that people have the ability to have a safe place to live, a good paying job or a job that allows them to have the lifestyle that they choose, that we try to minimize the activities that cause people to think this isn't a good place to live, and we try to maximize the things that we need to accomplish. So this is what, and I also say this, whenever I talk about quality of life, it's different often for many individuals as well as neighborhoods and communities. So in one community, you may feel like I've got the most, you know, successful home or development, and that works for them and they feel comfortable. But there, we have to recognize that there are other people that are homeless or that they don't have the ability to have an affordable place to live. That's a different kind of thing. And we've got to be more nimble with the idea of what do we try to accomplish so that everyone in this community feels like they have quality of life and their experience. So I would say that the things that we talk about on this program, transportation, affordable housing, good paying jobs, all of those things are contributors to what makes Charlotte a great place to live. And we are still seeing growth in our community. So I would think that people believe that we can have an positive impact on the quality of life in this community. And I hope that that's what we'll achieve.
We'll always have
to work at it.
You had no real competition in this last election cycle. Do you think that's because people just think, well, she's doing a good job, how can I run against this? or is it lack of interest?
I think, of course, it's not the lack of interest. No, I think that part of it was not just that simple. I think that we had the 1 year of work that we did before because we delayed our election because of the census numbers coming out late. So I think it was more the idea that, well, you've been in office for 1 year. What do you do with that second year? And I think that we have now this 2 years, and then we'll get back on track where I think there is interest in what the city does. I can tell that by the number of people that engage with us and the amount of work that the staff spends outside of our building. But I think that we will see the changes that an election can make, but we've got to increase the ideas of people coming to the polling places and voting. But I think the 1 year was really the issue there.
So Charlotte and Mecklenburg County combined have two Republicans in office in this local area, serving the local area. Do you believe, and I should say for the first time in 50 years, the GOP did not have a single primary. That means Republican voters, who make up about 17% of registered voters, eligible voters in Mecklenburg, were shut out. Is this healthy?
Well, I think that Republican voters have the ability to vote in the election just like Democratic voters. I hope that I have support from both parties. I hope that this council recognizes that we have a city that's made up of a political party. I would hope that anyone after an election that people feel that they can impact government just by being the person and the residents of this community.
Because unaffiliated voters are the second largest voting group in the city, and we have partisan elections in Charlotte, so it becomes almost impossible to run unless you have an R or a D by your name. An independent has got to go out and get people to sign petitions to get on the ballot. Is this something we should rethink?
Well, I don't know if we can rethink this because that is a state policy of how we run elections. I wish that we were in charge of this. Personally, I believe that we ought to try to have elections when there are more opportunities. You know, when this election happened, it was just for the Charlotte City Council. I don't think the partisanship is the issue as much as perhaps we need to have elections when the presidential years or other people like the Mecklenburg County Commission is on the ballot. We need to get people more interested in the total picture instead of just a small slice of the government pie.
So, because people have said that we have, one of the problems here is that we have too many elections. Almost every year we have an election. Some of them are more impactful than others. And you are in this off-year election where it was just pretty much you and a referendum on the school bonds, and that doesn't generate a heck of a lot of interest. Are you saying that's out of our hands? You can't move it? You'd need state permission to move those elections to the presidential election years?
I asked the city attorney that same question, and he said, yes, if we wanted to change the election year, we would have to go to the state legislature and ask permission to do that. Raleigh did that several years ago, so it's not something that's new, but it is an effort that we would have to have, and the council would have to take the position that that's what they wanted to do and pass it as a part of our governmental legislative requests.
Would there be pushback to that move from Raleigh?
We haven't had that discussion. I think it's a worthwhile discussion. We're going to have some opportunities to have that. The council, after the swearing-in ceremony, we'll have what we call a strategy session, and it will address whether or not we want to make some changes.
One more question about the election right after the break at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles, resuming our series of conversation. We took a little summertime break for vacations and for her to run for her fourth term in office, a race that she won. We are among, Mayor, only four cities, actually, in North Carolina that conduct partisan municipal elections. It's us, Winston-Salem, Sanford, and Lincolnton. Some believe that that leads to voter apathy, particularly at this level, because municipal elections are about keeping people safe, about picking up the trash, about making sure that the water and sewer systems work for people, and it's not really a Democrat-Republican kind of thing. These are not partisan issues. Should we consider having nonpartisan elections?
You know, a year ago, I believe, or maybe perhaps 2 years ago, we had a citizens committee that looked into this, and they recommended partisan and nonpartisan elections. That did not move forward with the council. So I think that that is, if something is going to change in the way that we do the elections, we really need to engage the community as well as the people that are, you know, invest in these political events, all of the, you know, the parties and all of that. So I think the question is, are we going to embark on that? And when we would, if we would do that, something would change. And I think that we would have to go through a process that's inclusive of the opinions of more people than just the council.
Because this was a very low turnout election, as most off-year special or midterm elections are, or municipal elections are, when they're not teamed up with other more higher offices. And Charlotte-Mecklenburg evidently is the lowest, traditionally has the lowest voter turnout in the state. Any theories as to why, and any appetite for working to change that?
Well, I don't know about the appetite to change it, because I have not heard from members of the community about that, or the council members. So, but we'll have the opportunity to have that discussion when it's raised, if it's raised. But I would suggest that, let me just say, I read something that said perhaps Mecklenburg County as a whole, we don't have the kind of thing that Raleigh does. And I've seen some of the numbers where Raleigh's turnout is much greater than
Mayor, you just inadvertently muted yourself. There you go.
Okay. So I think that there's tremendous difference when you're in a government town like Wake is, where you actually see every day the impact of the legislature, the city council, and all of the towns. Perhaps we just don't have that. Perhaps we need to figure out what makes it possible. And that's going to take some data and some information that we would have to have. And I think it's so important. Democracy is so important that we be inclusive of people that are invested in this, as well as those that perhaps need more information about whether or not they should invest in it.
Because we know that Raleigh they look at us askance. They don't like, there's not a lot of love lost between Charlotte and Raleigh. But if we played a bigger role in elections, if more people turned out, they would have greater weight and to kick around. Would that not be beneficial to Charlotte in the eyes of Raleigh to have everybody turn out for these elections?
Well, first, I think that we as a community, as our city, we do have great relationships in Raleigh. Maybe we don't always agree on what we ought to be doing, but I would like to say that when we call on, as you say, those basic principles that we have to have for how do we govern, I think our state legislators in Raleigh are really aware of who and what we are doing here. We've had some successes in our legislative package with them over the years. It's just that we sometimes don't always get everything that we want. So, but I would say that if you could think about this as a practice or a principle of democracy, you have to have something that everyone kind of pushes forward. I don't know the answer to that right now. I don't know what the community would say, what the voters would say. I'd love to ask someone like the Board of Elections, what do you think, and get some input if we're going to tackle this issue.
So earlier this month, CMPD was involved in the arrest of a woman at a bus stop that turned violent and which was caught on video by bystanders, and it went viral. CMPD is investigating, and they have said that body cam footage tells more of the story than the bystander video shows, but North Carolina law will not allow police to release body cam video without the permission of a judge, and CMPD has asked the judge for that permission. They are still waiting for it. Yesterday, Mecklenburg County's district attorney said that they will not prosecute that woman nor her companion who were arrested after allegedly smoking a marijuana cigarette, which led to that violent confrontation. And in dismissing the charges, Prosecutor Sheena Gatehouse wrote that after watching the police body camera footage as well as the recorded videos from bystanders, quote, the state does not have a reasonable likelihood of success at any potential trial in this matter, end of quote. What does that tell you?
That tells me that the DA has the information that he needed to make a decision, and he made the decision that we all have to respect and know that this is what he has stated. I think the biggest thing in this, first, let's go to the videos. We do want to have the ability to have the video shown to the public, and that's going to take place, I believe, tomorrow. That video will be publicly introduced, and then we will have the, I think that after we see the video, what we will have is the opportunity for Chief Jennings to define the next actions that we must take. I am grateful for this community, especially those folks that helped us get through the George Floyd incidents, for their patience and trust in our department to be able to make this kind of process work through the system. And now we have to look at the end of this process tomorrow and decide what determinants are needed to be changed, or if any need to be changed. So I want to say thank you to the community who have been patient with us. Thank you to those that believe and trust us enough to be able to do that, because that is one of the most important things that we can have and do, is to have the residents of this community really have the idea that we have a police department that's doing our very best.
I believe
Chief Jennings will be respectful. In fact, I think his comments about the DA's said that he would respect the DA's opinion. He may have been thinking about, well, what do you do next? But I think he really has been thoughtful throughout the process.
Have you seen the viral videos, the bystander videos?
I have seen the vice video. It has been,
Have you seen the body cam footage?
We do not. That's the thing that when you reference the idea that how we have to go to court to see it, the city council is just like a member of the public. And so I have not seen the video.
So you as mayor are not permitted to see the body cam footage.
That's exactly correct.
I have one word for that. Wow. For those people who have not seen the viral video that came out shot by a bystander, evidently a man and a woman were allegedly at a bus stop smoking a marijuana cigarette when officers approached them. And as they approached, the woman allegedly punched one of the officers, refused arrest, and a struggle ensued. Now, the viral video does not show the beginning of that encounter. It kind of picks up after she's already on the ground, being held down by several officers, and it does show one officer striking her thigh 7 times with his knee before hitting her peroneal nerve 10 times with a closed fist, all while she's on the ground and being immobilized by other officers. The man was allegedly carrying a 9mm pistol, but he did not resist arrest. She was apparently unarmed. When you saw that video, woman on the ground, officers on top, being punched 17 times, what did you think?
Well, I thought it was a very difficult video to watch, to see the strikes that are made, because that is part of the process that we have, or CMPD has now, in terms of making sure that people are compliant. Those words are very, very difficult for, I think, anyone to hear, that you have a strike for how do you maintain the safety of the officer, as well as make sure that you're following the rights of the alleged person that
but
you're working
with. But we haven't gotten the full rundown of this from Johnny Jennings, but it seems to me that when you have multiple officers on top of a victim, be it a man or a woman, and they are immobilized, does that necessitate further beatings? Is that an appropriate way to approach this in any situation?
I think that whenever we have training for our officers, and I do believe that the chief has said that this is one of the training aspects to bring people into compliance with the police request.
Should it be?
I can't address that, Mike. I don't know. I think that we have to think about how due process works for equally well for both the person, the Miss Pierre, as well as our officers. And that is not a simple yes or no answer. These things are complex and I know it would be easy to say, but we're trying to make sure that people are safe and that people understand what we're trying to do to maintain a safe community. This fell outside of what I would think that we want to see and do. And that's why it's just complicated, but we have to review. And I have to say something, I said something incorrectly. The body camera video won't be available tomorrow, but the hearing is tomorrow, whether or not the judge will release it so that we will be able to show it to the public. So I want to make sure that I correct that statement. But I think that we have to go through the due process for both. And the two people that were in the situation, they have legal representation. Our officers have processes that they have to follow, and CMPD will follow those processes. The last thing that we want is of the lack of trust in our community. And I think that we should do everything to maintain that. We should work with the people in this community that really care about how we conduct our officers, and that includes the police department. I think every officer that we have is trying to work towards doing the right thing. Now, if that's not the case, the chief will manage and handle it.
So this incident has obviously raised questions about the appropriateness of that level of force in this or perhaps any situation. But the other question that has also become part of this conversation is the justification for police approaching these two individuals in the first place. They were allegedly smoking marijuana, but the woman's attorney says that her client was smoking a THCA cigarette that she purchased from a local smoke shop, but police were unwilling to believe her. THCA is legal and evidently does not generate the high that marijuana does unless you burn and smoke it, which evidently, allegedly, she was doing. But we have a problem now because the laws over THC have been relaxed. And when you light that stuff, it smells like marijuana. And without having field testing equipment, perhaps you cannot tell. And smoking marijuana and possessing it is still not legal in North Carolina. Are the laws and the procedures adequate to address this new paradigm?
I actually listened to your WFAE's story about that, and it was clear that some of the folks that work in the Institute of Government or in this area where we're trying to look at governance, there has been some disconnect in it. I think that sometimes we can't figure out how to move as quickly as the community moves. So if we've got these stores that are opened and they're able to sell this product, yes, we do have a disconnect and we have to figure that out. And I think that this will help us in some respects define this issue. I do think that the challenges are keeping up with how the community can move faster, commerce can move faster than government can, and especially where we have rules that sometimes are statewide rules for our training and the efforts that we have to move people. Our officers will have to figure out what to do, but they have to also protect the laws that we have in place now until the laws change. There's a jeopardy in that. And so let's not put them in a jeopardized situation. Let's figure out what we should be doing as a governance as laws are made and how we need to address this issue. And right now, I think it's something that needs to be addressed
And
at the state level.
which at the state level, as well, was my going to be my question. They have to take care of this. Okay, so we got some good news since you were last here about a potential change of position by Norfolk Southern about the use of freight tracks for the proposed Red Line commuter train from Charlotte to Davidson, or from Davidson to Charlotte, depending upon your point of view. After years of opposition, the railroad is now considering allowing the Red Line to use its tracks. When were you first aware of this possibility? When we all heard it, or prior to our all hearing it on the news?
Well, I trust that we have some, we work with the professional staff here, our city manager, our CATS director, all of us, to think about what do we need to do to make this a reality for our city. And so I believe we are working with people that support the Red Line. We're very fortunate to have the ability to see that Norfolk Southern has adopted a change in position. And by sending us a letter that went to all of the mayors in Mecklenburg County to say that they are willing to have a negotiation, places us in a good position. I know that it's been the background, it's been in the background. The Red Line has been in the background for a long time, and people never thought that it would come up. But here we are today with the opportunity to think about commuter rail from the northern parts of our city, that which are experiencing high growth and lots of residential development, to have the ability to get people to move around without having a car.
So for years, Norfolk Southern did not appear willing to budge on this at all, and now suddenly the dam has sprung a leak. Do you understand why? What's changed? Have you been in conversations with them? And I have about 30 seconds.
I think that our staff has been in conversations with them, but I can't speak to what changes in a corporation like the Norfolk Southern. I've had the opportunity to meet several of their staff members, but I cannot say what their business plan and why it changed.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about the possibility of Red Line, about new CATS management, and about new investments in the Corridors of Opportunities, which is kind of a pet project for Mayor Vial Isles, our guest this hour on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles, our guest this hour. We were talking about the good news that came earlier this month. I think it was in November, could have been late October, from Norfolk Southern about a little thaw in their position on never using the freight line from Davidson to Charlotte for the Red Line commuter rail, which now they're saying, well, they might be open to that. But with good news often comes bad, and that is the case here as well. It turns out that the highly maligned express lanes from I-77 on I-77 from Davidson to Charlotte are actually working to reduce commute times for some. And because buses, express buses, can use those lanes free of charge and do, when you factor in the stops necessary for the Red Line to be effective, it would take 56 minutes for a full Red Line trip to Charlotte from Davidson, while it would only take 40 minutes to make the same trip on an express bus. And if that's the case, why should the city or any other entity move forward with what will be hundreds of millions of dollars when the bus is already there, running and faster?
Okay, so I am not a transportation expert, but let me take a stab at that. Today, the buses can move, but imagine as we continue to grow and we want to create a reliable system and predictable system so that when people say they have to be at work at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. and they want to go home at 4 or 5 p.m., that we have to have something that's much more reliable than the managed lanes, where we never quite know. Today we know, But as we grow, will we know and will the lane still accommodate the kind of traffic that will allow the bus, the express bus, to actually operate at the same speed of not only speed, but reliability of the train? I think that that's probably our biggest things is that riders on the rail don't typically have to wait for an accident or for if there's an accident and people are eyeballing it and slowing down. These are things that we can have, but oh, it's over time. This rail discussion has been going on for a very long time. It is not going to be something that we say, oh, we acquired the property and we're going to deliver a product in the next 2 years. We have to plan for the future. And that's one of the goals that we should have is to make sure that as we're building out our entire transportation system, that we think about our city as growing beyond the 900,000 people that we have, the county as having over 1 million people. Where are we going to provide adequate transportation and reliable, as well as choice? And that's what I think we have to really look at. And even if we say it's the same time now, I'm not so sure that that would be the case in the future.
Okay. You and council have just taken an action that have ruined my day, and that is
Oh, my.
you have chosen unanimously to hire a new company to run cats. So no longer will I be able to utter the words Rat P Dev. They are the company that have been running cats, the trains and the buses, for years. They've hired the operators, they've scheduled the drivers, they've negotiated the contracts. I think. For about 2 decades, and council decided to switch control to a company called National Express Transit that will take over, I believe, in February. Was this a decision a referendum on the previous company and all of the problems that we know about that CATS has suffered in the last year or two? Or was this simply time to change companies?
Obviously, we recognize the challenges that the bus system CATS has had over the past 2 or 3 years. I want to actually commend Ed Driggs and Lee Altman for working in a working group with other advisors on our staff. Brent Cagle is doing a great job, and we have actually addressed many of the challenges that we had after the change in leadership. The company, first of all, these companies are not exactly like a franchise that you can just say, well, we have many to choose from. And when we went through the process, we worked through the staff, did the process to bring in National Express. And in that process, they pointed out 18 performance metrics that would have to be made as a result of a better working system. While Brent Cagle has done a lot of work, the MTC has adopted and approved moving forward with this. And the idea that we would have is that we are integrating National Express. Sometimes I think, like anything else, you can get too comfortable, and perhaps that's what the other company was, just too comfortable that everything was just going along. But I know now, and all of us know now, there is a light that will always shine on CATS over the as we continue to address how we operate and what we do. And so in this negotiation for a new company, National Express Transit, we'll have a staff person on the ground in the office that will report to our CATS manager. And so this makes a big difference. It's actually more data-driven. It's more around incentives to get things done well and consequences when not done well. And so I think that between the City of Charlotte, the MTC, you can see major growth and change and good news about what we're doing in our system now.
So the 18 metrics that you mentioned to measure performance and whether they were doing a good job or a bad job, did that come from discussions among the people recruiting a company to run CATS, or did these 18 metric suggestions come from National Express itself?
I can't address that question. I mean, we'll get someone that will send you that answer.
Okay.
But my assumption is the contract includes them. That's what's most important. I don't know who introduced them, but we have things like metrics for missed trips, safety for our drivers, and on-time performance. I think those are the things that make a system work. And so no matter where the origination came in, it's important to have them. And there are incentives for doing this, and we're moving in the right direction. So I'm really supportive of this effort that we begin to think about a system that works for people that don't necessarily have cars, people that want to put their car in the garage and have a system that works for them. Reliability and safety, absolutely important.
And evidently, National Express Transit runs several large city systems already, so they're not new to the game here. But one of the problems that I think council members have expressed in the last several years about rat PDEV, the last time I'll ever have to say that, I suppose.
I think you're going to figure out another way to say it again.
I will. Was the fact that many council members were unaware of their existence, and they rarely, if ever, appeared before council. Should this new company make appearances before council?
Well, I think that they already have. Brent Cagle came in and walked through with the council the changes and the contracts, the things that I talked about, the metrics and all of that, the penalties, the incentives. So we already are on a different path for more observation for this contract and more opportunities to address the CATS issues and challenges. And we've just changed our direction. It's been a major, I would say, generational change right now.
Speaking of CATS and transit, and the fact that you brought up that over the summer, in place of you, we've been talking to other area mayors around Charlotte, all of them in our conversations, all of them to a person, were critical of Charlotte's power and influence on the Metropolitan Transit Commission, and most of them felt that the balance of power should be changed to give them a greater voice. You are the chair of that body. And back in September, when members of the commission wrote you a letter outlining their complaints, you issued a statement saying, quote, "We are reviewing the proposed amendments provided today by some members of the MTC regarding the future of public transit governance." Where does that stand this morning?
Well, first, I want to welcome Lee Altman to the chairmanship. The rules that we have under the agreement with MTC is that the city of Charlotte represents one term, and I had the responsibility to do that. But when we start off in 2024, Lee Altman will become the chair of the MTC. I think that the work that we're doing and the requests that were made, we have opened the work to agree that, yes, there are some changes that need to be made. But we've been doing that in a way that we envision at some point that CATS will become a regional authority. And so we're taking the steps to move forward to do that. And so when the letter came to me, I think that most of the recommendations and suggestions are certainly we can accommodate. And I'm glad that they sent the letter because with, you know, sometimes you have people that are not really working or agreeing with what you do. And to have something written that we can begin to take a document and begin to make it sure that we're all working together in a collaboration, that letter was really important to do that. And I appreciate that. So we are in the system where we're going to work together to look at the requests that the towns have. And there's some things that we will work on. And I didn't see anything in the letter that said, we shouldn't do it. It's just how to do it.
One of the universal complaints that we heard in these conversations with area mayors was that Charlotte kind of acted like a bully in all of this, that Charlotte has the biggest voice in all this, and they felt as though they were being regarded as a rubber stamp for whatever Charlotte wants, Charlotte gets. Are they wrong in that assessment?
Well, first, I hate to use the word bully because I think that if you look at our meetings, there has been conversation and there's been the ideas that, you know, votes have been taken. And I have to be one of the people to say to you that I sat on the CATS board and not knowing all of the things and opportunities that I had to impact it. And I think a lot of that was just the way that we have done business, that we've changed now. So when you think about this, my vote is equal to the vote of one. Every in the MTC, everybody has one vote. If you go back and look at our history, they're usually pretty much unanimous. But when we had the challenges in CATS, that gave us a whole new blueprint to work from. And so now we have the ability to have that openness and to have that discussion. But I believe that generally when Brent Cagle has looked at this, we are in, again, the kind of sync that this we working collaboratively together. And that when people perhaps feel a little bit more comfortable with dissension. And I think that that's a good thing.
Okay. A while back, Charlotte identified six areas deemed to be corridors of opportunity to help lift up those areas, help locals in those areas to build small businesses, etc. And recently, Charlotte City Council unanimously approved nearly $4 million. I've heard slightly less. I've heard slightly more. So I'll look to you for the exact figure for workforce and small business support in those corridors. The money is scheduled to go through six nonprofits, one assigned to each of the six corridors. So how will this work, and how will you make sure that the money does what it's intended to do?
Well, first, it's $4.5 million is distributed among all of our corridors. And the idea behind this is that we need to be as nimble as possible to help people. And I've often said, long term, that we needed to invest because we disinvested for so many years, we need to build back up. And so some of these are opportunities. So I had the opportunity to go over on the Enderley Park side of town to make this announcement. And each corridor has a specific agreed upon plan that they're going to operate. But generally it is around, what do the people in the neighborhood, do they need jobs? Do they want to start a business? Do they have childcare? Do they have sufficient food to have? So all of these things are really important. A hub is going to be located in a place that you can come in and express your future. And that's what we want to do. We talk about quality of life. Quality of life comes best when we have opportunities for people. So this is a part of our work around upward mobility and opportunity for those places that we haven't invested in, like other communities or other parts of our community.
And just as a sidebar, yesterday the city announced that the Wells Fargo Championship and the city's Corridors of Opportunity team are launching an electric bike pilot program along the North Tryon Corridor. The tournament is donating $300,000 for this. What do you see this accomplishing?
Well, you know, I have heard other cities have done this. They are actually making electric bikes more affordable for people that need transportation and would have the ability to move around on an electric bike. And I think that we've got a lot of work to do in terms of how we want to have bike lanes available. But this is one of the things that this country is actually dealing with for sustainability. The idea that if people are living in a community that's bikeable, if we can provide them, and I thank Wells Fargo Championship for this donation for e-bikes, that means you don't have to go up the hill as hard and you can go to work and still feel kind of freshly dressed and ready to go for the day. I think that's an important part of our sustainability as well as our mobility plan.
So I have 40 seconds left. On Monday, City Council approved an additional $950,000 to reopen bus lanes on Independence Boulevard. They've already given $750,000 toward that effort to NCDOT, so it's $1.7 million now. These bus lanes were put in years ago, and then they were closed, and now they want to reopen them, I think, as lanes for cars, like express lanes for cars. Why were they closed? What will it take to reopen them?
Well, if we all remember the bridge over across Independence, there was a lot of delay in that project. And I think that that's what stopped us in some ways from getting to the bus lanes. But NCDOT is a project manager for the project that we're doing now. And I believe that the entire route from Hawthorne Lane to Sharon Forest Drive will really reduce travel time with the buses. So it goes to the fact that we can have bus lanes.
Is it going to be just for buses, or are we going to use them for cars?
Yeah. Oh, this is a bus lane.
Just
not
for
a
bus
car
lanes.
Lane.
Okay, so just for buses.
All right. This is just buses.
And with that we are out of time. Mayor Vialize, welcome back. Hope to see you again next month or in the near future. Thank you for doing it.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.